Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS. I'm here with Thea Leonarduzzi, who's wearing a full coat.
Yep.
Despite it being indoors.
Yes.
I just want to be clear, I'm in a t-shirt because I don't feel the cold, but I don't want people to think that I'm patriarchically setting the temperature.
Yeah. To minus one.
But that's the thing, isn't it, that they do think that it's rooms are designed for male...
Well, they don't think it, it's just true. Historically they were.
Yeah, but I have not set this room temperature.
No,
but
I can,
some other man...
I can confirm that Stig has not imprisoned me in a cold box.
but the patriarchy more broadly has.
The patriarchy, yeah, more broadly, yes, I think that's probably still the case.
I wanted to ask you a question about Alf, because I feel that we've raised him up as a key feature,
yes,
of this podcast.
He's almost like a
third presenter. Yeah, and to be honest, for some people it's the best and only good bit of the podcast. So I mean, it feels a shame if we don't mention him. You've got some news about him, haven't
I
you?
I have. It's big news.
Big news
in his little world. Although I don't imagine he cares very much.
No.
He is in fact a rare breed.
How do you know?
Because someone got in touch, having seen a picture that my husband posted, saying our lovely...
Immodestly.
Our lovely Heinz 57 rescue
mongrel
dog. Yeah.
And what is he?
He is, in fact, apparently, a Berger Picard, which is a sheepdog from Picardy.
Yeah.
That some date back to 900 AD.
Of course you've got a continental dog. I mean... Of course.
Well, I mean, yeah, he's rescued from Romania, so you can't really get more content.
No, and is he pedigree then?
No,
but he's got other bits in it.
But it's just strange. I mean, who knows how that happened? It's an incredibly rare breed. There were, I think, 40 in the UK, and they were almost wiped out by two consecutive world wars because they mostly lived on farms in northern France. And so then
not
Somme,
a safe place to be, yeah.
Exactly, not the best place for them. So this is a ridiculous thing, and he doesn't care, and we don't care, but it's
nice.
Quite funny.
And it's a bit of historical. Yeah, I love that. How do you say it?
Berger Picard.
Lovely. Get your cheap subscriptions to the TLS if you haven't got one already. If you live in the US or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. It's 5 notes for 5 issues. Who could say fairer than that? And speaking of the business of producing words for cash, this week's paper has a journalism bent. Alex Clark has been delving in the archives of Granter magazine, which is 40 years old this year. What does she learn about how to edit a literary magazine? No, seriously, I'd like to know. We've also asked a whole bunch of TLS contributors to nominate their favourite magazine, those endangered species in the modern world of clickbait and revenue harvested by those amoral leeches at Facebook. We'll talk that over with Catherine Morris, an editor here at the TLS, and Ros Dineen, Minister of Fun. Plus, Lydia Davis talks about doing her garden. She does it in a literary way, obviously. Now, what is your favourite magazine? If you didn't think immediately of the TLS, shame on you. This week we, or rather Catherine, because it was her idea, asked some TLS contributors to nominate their favourite magazines and why. And we got a lot of titles and lots of reasons. Nancy Campbell mentions the joy of a magazine arriving by post, but not too frequently, which may be a finger wag in our direction. And Miranda France, the thrill attendant on the sound of a magazine dropping through the letterbox. But what about digital versions? They mean that we can all read more widely, more easily, against one's inclination, as Lisa Hilton puts it, or with more ready proximity to a distant location. But as Benjamin Markovitz says, you can't collect websites. Magazines are also important as nostalgic markers, central to both Keith Miller's memory of his sustained pash on the music press in my teens and early 20s, and Roy Foster's recollections of the surprisingly raunchy short stories in Argosy. We got some wild and wonderful suggestions too. Dennis Duncan gets his In Utilis research from the organ of the London Institution of Pataphysics. Barbara King learns about everything from pig personality to pinniped seal memory from Animal Cognition. Happily, she does admit to a fondness for Entertainment Weekly too. She should talk to Frances Wilson, who's been enjoying Hello magazine, and someone in the piece gratuitously insults the LRB. We'll get to all that with Catherine and Roz too. Hello, hello.
Hi.
Kaz, it's a really nice idea. How keen were people to share their magazines? Did people say, oh yeah, I really want to talk about something? Was it sort of personal to
really
them?
Yeah, keen. About three or four people responded by saying, oh, that sounds really fun. And I think that comes through quite nicely in the pieces themselves. There's quite a strong vein of nostalgia, as you said.
It is nostalgic, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. What? Benjamin Markovitz, he remembers the shelf of National Geographic in his grandparents' house, and he had a ritual of reading the new issue of Sports Illustrated with a 12-pack of Dunkin' Donuts.
And he's a giant basketball player of a man.
Benjamin oh, is Marco. He?
Yeah, he was a good basketball player, so he can take his donuts, I think, happily without. Was it important to anyone here have a nostalgic memory of magazines?
I'd forgotten about Smash Hits.
Did you honestly read Smash Hits?
Of course.
Did you put the posters up?
Of course.
Did you write?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I'd forgotten that I'd done that, but yeah, I did.
Any posters you want to remember?
I'm sure I had some Take That ones. I had Smash Hits and what was it called? Was it called Sugar?
Oh, so you read teeny girl magazines?
Yeah, when I was a teeny girl.
Yeah. And what do you remember of them? Were they good?
I think that so much of what I got out of them then is all done. I mean, obviously, I thought they were good then. It's all done on Instagram now.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing, because you're going there for looks and ideas and celebrities, and then they have all the hair products and all that stuff, and the whole thing is done on Instagram by the celebrities themselves now.
But I wonder how that, my parents, whenever they'd come to England or when I'd come to England, would bring back issues of, do you remember Ms. Magazine?
Yeah. Oh, vaguely, yeah.
And I don't remember any of what I read except for one feature, which was I think 3 pages, and it was all about puppy farms.
That sounds like pretty tough journalism.
And it was amazing.
Yeah,
that was probably the first serious journalism I read.
And yet,
I can
there was
still
a kind of moral
the
panic
pictures and everything.
But there was a kind of moral panic about these magazines, weren't there? Because there was, I think, the Daily Mail would often harumph over the fact that they had
probably,
the
but
position
when
of the, didn't they have
them,
position of the
was,
week?
That
did
was
they have
Now magazine?
And
yeah.
that and it was positioned. It was aimed at 15-year-olds, and everyone was going, "That's illegal."
It was completely inappropriate.
Yeah,
yeah.
And Teen Vogue, it made me think of that. Was German Teen Vogue became big in the American election? Do you know Teen Vogue?
Oh yes, because they had proper journalism.
They had
in
proper
it.
Politics. Yeah. It was a really, but then it's gone online, and that's seen in some ways as a failure, sort of not being able to sell. But that doesn't feel right.
I wonder whether because of things like Instagram and the readers of someone like, I don't know, Vogue or whatever, can now get so much of the same stuff from their social media. I wonder whether it's made the magazines do more of the really good writing and really good essays. So in Vogue now you have like Zadie Smith. Eva Wiseman does this amazing column.
Do you read Vogue?
No, but I have seen these pieces and they're online. But I wonder whether Vogue and publications like that have gone almost more wordy
in
the face of Instagram.
Kaz, I've got an embarrassing thing I read. Do you have any magazines you read? Did you read magazines growing
Not
up?
Not really. As I mentioned the other day, I remember being beside myself with excitement at joining the Fun Day Times Club.
I got the Fun Day Times.
Why is the Fun Day Times Club?
Do you remember what it involved? I don't.
There was a bookmark. I remember that much.
Well done, Kaz. That's the most excited I think I've seen anyone ever be, more or less, on
really
this podcast.
Really on brand as well.
Yeah, it is. Part of the, I read heavy metal magazines. Which, again, hardly don't exist anymore. But they used to be Metal Hammer, Krang, and one called R.I.P. I remember as well. It was all sort of tough, long-haired men playing guitar. But there was a kind of a romance to them. Theo and I were talking about this elsewhere, where they could afford to send someone to go off drinking with Guns N' Roses or whatever. And that would have cost, you know, thousands of pounds to send someone to L.A. and pay all the expenses and all the hotel bills. And yet they did it. And Do people do that now? I don't know. Maybe they. I mean, I suppose there's just fewer big magazines now, aren't there?
Yeah, and I think lots of that expensive stuff is done in places like the New York Times go and do those expensive celebrity profiles and stuff now. It used to get in places like, I suppose, Vanity Fair used to be the place for that.
Someone has a go at Vanity Fair in this, don't they?
Yeah. It was Bernardine Evaristo.
Oh, yeah, the Booker Prize winner. I used to be a big fan of Vanity Fair when it had the money to produce epic features, even though I disapproved of its relentless whiteness and preppiness, which it seems to be a fair comment. I've been reading about Jonathan, so I'm reading Jonathan Franzen again, where I was talking about the corrections. And if you look at him and Tom Wolfe and people like that, they made their names writing for Harper's and Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair, probably. So there was a whole place where I mean, I'm sure the whiteness argument from Bernardine Evaristo is very true, that it was a certain type of person who got that. But does that exist? I wonder if that exists now for writers. Is there a place to go and get loads of money or good money to go and write beautiful 8,000 word pieces of journalism?
There's certainly much, much less of it than there used to be. And it used to be, like you say, a sort of platform where writers, they had really good editors, and writers like Franzen were sort of developed on these, what we would now consider to be quite an unusual platform for a literary figure to start off on.
Well, Playboy was the other thing, it used to be. I never quite get that, but that's true, isn't it? That, you know, Norman Mailer went for
Playboy.
Yeah,
amazing writers.
Did anyone want to read any magazines based on recommendations or in here? Kaz, what was your favourite one?
Well, the one that sprang to mind was Inventory, but I realised that I'm actually quite happy not to read that magazine. I just really enjoyed reading Keith Miller's description.
What's Inventory?
I'll read a bit out. He says, it was set up by a ragged-trousered band of art school postgraduates in the mid-1990s and sustained in the face of widespread indifference for maybe 4 years. Between its buff covers adorned with bravely unstylish typography, the effect was of some discredited Egyptologist's quarterly vanity project. It made space for yammering pub sociologists, lunatic testaments harvested from phone boxes, neo-dadaist bricolages Stanley knived from magazines, peri-digital robotext, and perhaps a few too many of what would later be called stands of the great Ian Sinclair, neurosthetic jeune homme sérieux in stout boots, undertaking programmatic journeys through seething London streets.
I don't want to read that.
Nor do I. I think with a lot of these magazines, not these specifically, but with a lot of magazines and journals, you don't necessarily want to read them, but you want to know that they're there. But and then you see the rise of this kind of subscription as donation phenomenon, where people don't cancel their subscriptions, but just continue paying even as the issues, you know, build up.
Do people do that with the TLS?
I mean, probably.
Bernardine Evaristo mentions that she subscribes to Mislexia and Poetry Review.
Oh, well, there you go.
Which I can never find the time to read.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of.
But she wants to support it because it's important.
Do you think we feel more attached to hard copies? Do you think that what seems to have happened? I mean, Lisa Hilton says we can read against our inclinations a bit more because you don't have to subscribe to a magazine to read a couple of articles on it. Do you think that's a healthy thing that's happening, or do we actually lose a bit of the loyalty?
I mean, I still have a shelf of copies of old magazines. Things like Granta is a really nice thing to have. M+1, I have some of those. And I have some, you know, an issue of the first issue of Love magazine or whatever. And they are, like, they're really...
Does that still exist?
I don't know. Man. But I have one beautiful issue. It's stunning.
Yeah.
And, that you know, it's quite nice to have a few.
Do they feel old-fashioned, I wonder, as a thing? I mean, in the same way that art, they feel... that's not a term of dispraise, not least because, you know, we are a magazine. But they feel an artifact of an age where people valued something tactile, and we're moving ever further away from that age.
Maybe, but it's also different to the book in that there's a dynamism with magazines and journalism that you can't have as much with books. And part of the appeal, we were talking about this earlier, about, I mean, I don't think I have any active subscriptions at the moment. And what I love best is going to a place, and that's quite often a pub, quite often in the north, because there seems to be a really strong culture of this, but just reading whatever I find. So there's loads of zines lying about and little magazines and you know, that sort of thing. And that's a really exciting world where you're, it's all discovery rather than choosing to take out a subscription to something that you know you will enjoy.
You want to have the variety.
It's the lucky dip, I suppose.
I think Lynn Murphy makes a really interesting point. She says, nowadays I flit among online subscriptions, reading nothing from cover to cover. It's a loss in that I no longer get to know the editor's voice from the page to page. Now it's just the writer in view. So the whole vision of the project is important. It's not just individual voices.
I think that's true. When I first read Private Eye, I didn't have a clue what was going on, because you end up with codes and kind of running gags and things like that. And one of the pleasures maybe is the clubbiness of it, in that you're part of a gang and you're getting the same thing. But that can also feel kind of constricting after a while. So I don't know whether it's a good or bad thing, but that's an interesting point, that if you only read everything because someone's shared it on Facebook, you might massively broaden your experience. So you might get something from Teen Vogue and you might get something from The Spectator without ever wanting to, or even being likely to, subscribe to either of those things. And maybe that's good, but do you miss it? Yeah. Maybe that's right. Maybe you miss something.
You do, I think, because you as you just said, you lose like the editor's voice and the editor's vision. I get a...
Is that true, do you think?
I think so. I get a subscription to The New Yorker, which was a present, and it's the best present I've ever had. And every issue, when you have it in your hands, you can sort of see there's one piece that's going to move you, one piece that's really in-depth. The flow and the selection in each issue is something that you miss if you just go online and click onto the things that you want to read.
Yeah, and at the TLS, a lot of thought goes into...
Yeah, exactly.
There are echoes and...
And you try to do it,
yeah.
I'm interested whether people actually appreciate that or not. I feel like in an era of... It's a nice gift, I think that's right, but does it feel like you're standing for something? I just wonder whether it becomes more than the basis of actually enjoying it. You think, if I'm a subscriber to The New Yorker, it says about something about who you are. I'm struck by this, probably magazines out there, I'm not going to name the one that immediately occurs to me, which is probably Little Red, but subscribed to, because in doing so you're saying, I am that person. Does that
matter?
Yeah. Yeah. Does that matter? I mean, it's sort of, it gets back to being part of a club again, isn't it? Maybe. And maybe people want to be part of a club.
Mm.
Neil Mukherjee, he wants to talk about the Boston Review, and he likes the Boston Review, but he begins with what could only be described as a gratuitous pop at the LRB, which it would be remiss of me not to read out. Boston Review is what the London Review of Books aspires to be but will never be, because it is hectically caught up in perpetuating its own exclusionary politics while talking the left liberal progressivist talk. That originally had the phrase self-fellating in it, which was edited for reasons of taste and should never be brought into public.
Brought back
into the public domain. And I have done, but Neil Mukherjee was happy for the accusation of self-fellating to go onto the public record. For reasons of taste and editorial tone, so important in a magazine, I think we can agree. I think people do feel strongly about this stuff, though, don't they? I mean, I got the sense in all of this, Catherine, that this passionate. This is people want to make the case for things.
Yes, definitely. And I think actually a good example of this was Yasmin Seal, who wrote about Badoon, which is a magazine of arts and culture from the Middle East. And so she began her article, I forget the details, a friend's house probably in the late 2000s, but the feeling of the first encounter remains vivid, a thrill of recognition, of belated thirst. People often don't know what they want to read until they read it. And before I found Badoon, I didn't know I craved a magazine in English written by people who spoke or half-spoke other languages at home. And the whole piece is a sort of love letter to this magazine, which she said had a formative influence.
Do you know what that makes me think of? Because we're about to relaunch the website of the TLS, we're about to redesign it. One of the points about relaunching the website is serendipity in a magazine seems to be really important. Everything is based, this world now, the modern world, on things you already know you like. So if you're following people on social media who recommend stuff, they're recommending to your taste already, or you've already made a decision either consciously to read against yourself or to read into your own taste. So it's either something very different or it's something completely attuned to you. And what you lose then is a sense of multiplicity. And it strikes me, editing the TLS, and one of the things that we can do, serendipity is really important, isn't it? Because you don't know what you don't know, without wishing to get all Rumsfeld about it. But no, and stumbling across something seems to me to be a real, it's a real joy in life. You know, like when you go to a secondhand bookshop and you pick up a book. You know, I found Gore Vidal, never having really heard of him, when I was about 19. And there just happened to be a Gore Vidal book in a charity shop for £1. I bought it and then I read everything he wrote. is that a virtue here, the sort of attic mentality of, you know, you can prod around and find things?
I think that's one of the things I enjoyed about this feature, actually, that you're not commissioning a particular piece. You don't know what they're going to write about.
No, and did you expect to get Hello Magazine?
No, it's thrilled.
From a couple of people, in fact.
No,
yes, that's right. Somebody else mentions it. Who
did they? Frances Wilson loves it. She says it's high camp comic value, second to none. The oleaginous interviews, the footballers' wives, the celebrities in ball gowns posing in spanking new fitted kitchens, and the infamous Hello Curse. The Hello Curse is like the Strictly Curse, that they do make a big flurry about a marriage.
And then it ends.
And then it ends.
Oh, I see.
But when I started in journalism working at the Press Complaints Commission, Hello Magazine and OK Magazine were, I can't tell you how big they were.
Yeah.
They used to spend $300,000 or $400,000 buying up people. So when someone got married, someone in that sort of super footballery reality TV fame levels, mm-hmm. it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds. And there used to be legal cases. Someone had, I can't remember if it was Hello or OK, had the wedding of Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Oh, yeah. And she was too tall.
She was too tall.
Finish your story, yeah, then I'll tell you the story.
Okay. What they did was they had it and they paid £1 million for it. And then one of their rivals snuck in and took pictures. And she sued for privacy and said she was violated by the second magazine taking pictures because she'd commercially sold them to a first magazine. And she won, I think. They had to pay damages.
No, but the story I remember from that is the reason she was so upset about the pictures that leaked to the second magazine was because in them her husband looked much shorter than her. Because in real life, he is much shorter than her.
Yeah.
But in the carefully staged photos for Hello, there was a sort of parity of height.
But the other magazine had sort of shown the platform he was standing on.
Standing on a box.
This is where everyone comes for their celebrity gossip. This podcast, right here.
But this was a big, and it's a Spanish magazine originally, Hello, Hola, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What's in Italy, what's the magazine culture like?
Oh, there's Gente is a big one.
What's
Gente, People.
Are we sort of tabloidy level? Is that
the
sort of...
Yeah, it's a smaller format, more portable. But yeah, it's the same sort of tabloids, I think, a crossword or two.
See, we have in this country those very real life magazines, which you guys will not have seen, not being people of a certain age, but I saw when I was at the PCC, so, you know, Now and...
Oh, Take a Break.
Take a Break, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Those magazines were big for a while, but as technology has come along, the market has thinned out. I mean, if we're having this conversation in 10 years' time, what do you think, if we're having this conversation in 10 years' time, will it all be retrospective? Will it all be, do you remember the good old days? Even Neil Muckerjee will be saying the good old days of the LRB.
At the moment, I can't really think straight because I'm busy thinking of... I'm thinking of the school friend who hit on this brilliant ruse of the tips column in those True Life magazines.
Yes, I do.
She would get all the tips from one magazine and then submit them to a different magazine.
No.
Yeah.
Can I tell you one of the tips?
Successfully? Oh, yeah.
Can I tell you one of the tips? I remember this from reading these magazines at work. Instead of having after dinner mints, take blobs of toothpaste and freeze them.
You could do initials and,
I
thought we were going to be talking about stinging flies.
I know.
In-house.
Stinging fly is... I love stinging fly.
Stinging
wonderful.
Fly is brilliant.
The future of magazines.
Yeah.
Tell
us why you like stinging fly. Let's elevate the tone briefly then.
Oh, stinging fly is brilliant. I mean, I think it's edited by Sally Rooney now, isn't it?
Not anymore. I think she was just for 2018. I don't know who it is now.
I suspect she won't need
but
to
But you just get just a beautiful mix of new writers, new voices,
and the quality is
fiction
really
and
high.
Non-fiction.
Yeah.
And does it make? I mean, how big is this type of? I'm interested in those type of magazines because you hear about them and you see copies and they kind of look lovely. Grant is a bit like this back in its pomp, probably, where they kind of have the status of books because there's not many. It's not published every. I mean, how often is Stinging Fly published?
Two
quarterly
times a
year or something like that. So it's basically a book, really, isn't it? A mini, beautifully produced book. Is that a thing? Do you think? I mean, could that ever be scalable to something bigger, or is it just very high end, very high culture that's targeted at a very small audience?
Well, there'll certainly be people who work in publishing. Everyone who works in publishing will probably have a subscription to Stinging Fly because it's all of the good new voices seem to start out there.
Do we have one in the office?
Yeah, I think we do.
I never see it. Who snaffles
well,
it?
Well, we sort of take it in turns to snaffle it. Yeah, sorry. But the importance of talking about Stinging Fly and of people taking out subscriptions to Stinging Fly is drilled home to us this year because Tin House, which is sort of like an American equivalent of Stinging Fly, was based in Oregon, has folded this year.
Has it?
After 20 years. The last issue was in June.
And Sports Illustrated, which Ben Markowitz mentions, there was a big news story last week that said they're effectively, it's been bought by someone else and it's being gutted. Mm. Because to run these, I mean, The New Yorker has a million subscribers. I wonder how much money it makes, because it will spend an awful lot of money producing that. Mm. And obviously Sports Illustrated can't make money because they're cutting half of it. There is a financial restriction on all of this, I would imagine. Talking of The New Yorker, let's just end on this because it praises the TLS. Did you say to people not to praise the TLS, Kaz, by the way? Or just leave them to do that.
Yeah.
But there was no guidance in either direction.
No.
So Stephen Brown says The New Yorker currently in a down phrase. Where have you gone, Thurber, Benchley, O'Hara, Salinger? But still the best thing to settle on the couch with, New Yorker. Fine woodworking, he likes. A model for how to teach techniques in print, and the TLS, essentially the same paper that Virginia Woolf wrote for, which is good enough for me.
And Virginia Woolf is writing for us again, sort of.
She is. Soon. We've published a book of Virginia Woolf's essays on all sorts of things.
Out on November 28th.
Well done, Ross.
Thank you.
It's commercial things like that, which might mean in 10 years' time, the TLS is still here. Hurrah for that.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
As literary magazines go, Granter is comparatively nubile and fresh-faced, scampish 40 years old, which is nothing when you think about it and you work for a groaning 120-year-old geriatric. There may be other literary magazines turning 40 this year too, but I just can't think of any of them by name. Anyway, Alex Clark, literary hack extraordinaire, once was the editor of Granter back in 2008, so she was the perfect person to delve into its archive and find some gems from its history. And she did. She's here with Thea and me now. Alex, hello.
Hi. Did I okay the hack extraordinaire?
Literary hack extraordinaire.
Okay, I
felt that was quite...
That changes everything.
Yeah, let's go.
I felt literary and extraordinaire kind of nicely bracketed the word hack. Let's talk about Granter. Because people might not know about it. I mean, a lot of people will know about it. It's been around a long time. But how did it begin? What was it trying to do? What's the purpose of
Granter? I see you flexing your, you know, we're a very old literary magazine.
Gotta give us some
muscles.
Give us something.
But actually, of course, it started in 1889.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It did.
It started and then it stopped.
But
yeah.
Sure,
there was
a hiatus. And in its revamped 40-year-old edition, it is quite a different beast, obviously. So,
what was it in 1889?
Well, it was a sort of a student mag, really, but of, you know, of a sort of literary bent, with all sorts of, you know, luminaries who wrote for it and did. I think A.A. Milne was the editor at one point. You know, that sort of a thing. But I certainly don't think it was the kind of place that you would have expected to find an issue called Dirty Realism, for example.
No.
Or More Dirty Realism.
So what happened to it? So Bill Buford takes it over.
Exactly. So, well, it went into abeyance, you know, and I imagine it went the way of all things. You know, lack of interest, lack of funds. That's what always happens. And then Bill Buford, who at that point was in the kind of in academia in Cambridge, revives it and decides that it is going to be an absolute breath of fresh air in the literary world and bring us fiction was kind of how it, you know, its starting point. That's what he wanted. And of course, he wanted to bring loads of American writers into it, which he did. And he just wanted to kind of shake things up.
And was it a success in those terms?
Well, I suppose that really depends how you measure success.
Indeed.
I mean, what was amazing about going into the archive, which is as yet uncatalogued. It's just been acquired by the British Library. So it's kind of been sorted into an order, but nobody knows absolutely where everything is in it. So what you get is a kind of the wonderful curators there just kind of bring you some gems, and then you say, well, could I poke about in that box? But it is just box upon box upon box upon box.
And it's commissions as well as meeting minutes.
Yep,
and
yep, exactly. The whole thing. So there's correspondence in, correspondence out, meeting minutes, which are kind of, I mean, obviously there weren't any minutes at the beginning. You know, it was kind of back of the envelope.
Was it just mates kind of to get, I mean, there's, you talk a bit about the financial arrangements of it, that the reason Granter was late publishing, because you are always late.
Yes, checks are being typesetter.
Checks are being rejected.
Well, you feel like the typesetter, because these turn out to be, the details are actually more fascinating than Philip Roth saying, no, my dear fellow, I don't have, you know, a piece for you this month or whatever. That's actually more fascinating when you read a kind of tirade from a typesetter who has clearly just had enough. And actually, it's quite a long letter of which I've just kind of quoted a bit. But he's essentially going, get your act together. Yeah. I mean, he actually says, get your act together.
Which, of course, people have been saying to editors and backbench people for all of, since journalism's existence, you've not sorted out. You're missing your deadline.
Yeah, copy flow, etc. Yeah, where's your stuff? Where's the money? And editors, of course, like to go, but the words.
Yeah,
the words. Yeah.
I can't come down to that level. I'm thinking of great ideas. What are your favourite discoveries then? I thought the fantasy commissioning.
Oh, it's just brilliant.
It's just absolutely magnificent.
Because we've all done it.
Oh God, I was thinking
how
exactly the same.
How many times have you, you know, in your august career as also a hack extraordinaire, not sort of that an editor has wandered by, because you are the editor now, somebody wandered by and go, do you think you could get Martin Amis to write this piece? And you think, well, what I'll do is bring the speaking clock for 3 days and then I'll write it.
Yeah.
Right?
Do I do that, do you think, TMI, a bit unrealistic?
I think we all do that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's
me. But I think we know when... I think we're all guilty of that.
But I do think there is a certain aspect of it is worth punting 100.
Absolutely.
Of course, wouldn't want to read Gabriel García Márquez on cockfighting?
And I love the fact that...
Well, because he just didn't write that piece.
I love the fact that they got it written anyway.
Like, well, once you've had an idea, I mean, but that's the way it goes, isn't it? So who would be brilliant to write this? Yeah. Well, obviously, he would.
Have names on a post-it.
Yeah, exactly. And you go down. And of course, when you are the person who ends up writing that piece, you're always like, God, was I? You tell yourself you were second. You'd settle for 10th. You fear that you might be 50th.
I mean,
I don't think Charles Nicol was, who did end up writing that piece.
No,
and it's a really good piece.
And who else was it? Because the headline is Angela Carter on wrestling.
Yeah. Well, of course, there is, I mean... You know, this kind of thing obviously bears fruit, doesn't it? Because you have the kind of famous issue of Granter in which Ian Hamilton writes about Gaza Agonistes. You know, and that's what became, in a way, Granter's hallmark. And I remember, I mean, it sort of spreads through the industry, doesn't it? I remember somebody once saying to me, oh God, I'm a middle-aged man, I'm going to be sent to do something interesting like climbing, becoming a steeplejack or something. Yeah. You just sort of fear this. But of course, when you've got these amazing writers, like the bit where they want to send Bill Bryson to Butlins.
Somewhere cold.
Is that what it was?
Somewhere cold and miserable.
And then he also, at one point, I don't know if we eventually could include this, he had the space to include this, but he kind of laments that although he would love to go to Butlins for Christmas and New Year, alas, he's too busy this year.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, but yes, Somewhere Cold and Miserable. Of course, Bill Bryson's kind of made a career out of going somewhere cold and miserable, hasn't he?
Well, indeed. You know. The thing he's, I mean, the first three books is basically that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's America, Europe and Britain, where he's mordant about being a bit miserable.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I love Bill Bright.
Oh, yes, none of this is...
I've tried to commission him and he's actually very nice and you get a reply
saying...
Do you
want him to be a steeplejack?
I've tried and...
This is all going into our archive, which we'll hand on to the British Library and...
I hope my emails are not going into our archive.
Well, this is the interesting thing. I mean, apart from the fact that there are, as I said, just boxes and boxes and boxes, and it is as uncatalogued, and the BL think it's going to take somebody like a year to do it. You know, a person. It'll be a person who has that whole job. That is their job. So...
And do they commit to making all this pub... I mean, so... Have they checked to see there's nothing really embarrassing in it? I mean,
I suppose that will be part of the archivist's job. I mean, to put stuff... Well, actually comes a very, very interesting thing. Do you want, when you come to kind of live these, you can't put people's home addresses, for example, into the public
domain.
But
imagine if someone had said something disparaging about a woman or disparaging about... You know, it's not impossible over 40 years...
Well, it's entirely possible. It's entirely actually happens.
Plausible.
Yeah, and what are the ethics of? Yeah, do you strike it from the record?
Have Granter said to the British Library, when you give up your archives, do you say warts and all? If you find that an editor said, you know, use some slur, I'm not saying that it's possible to Granter, but it's not impossible when these are genuine minutes and genuine scrawls
that started
and jottings
in the '70s.
Yeah,
exactly.
79.
Well, I think I have kind of alluded to the fact that there is a certain machismo about.
Can I say how you refer to that, Alice
yes,
Clark?
Please
because
do.
There was a lot of penises at Granter, is what you say.
Well,
not so many penises that they couldn't say no to Philip Roth, though.
Did they say no to Philip Roth?
They did at one point. I mean, there's an awful. And again, you know this kind of thing. It's that awful sort of constantly asking people for stuff. Have you got any stuff? Would you like to write a piece on? Mm. And then sometimes, perhaps years later, you know, you do get a piece and you think, oh, this isn't quite what we need. So it's quite a lot of that.
We've spiked, since my time editing the TLS, one properly commissioned piece. You know, a couple of reviews have gone by the wayside, but a genuine... commissioned essay.
I don't think you can say that unless you give us a little hint. I know you're not going to say
I'm not
who
say
it
the
is,
name.
But
okay.
You have to give us
okay,
a
I'll
bit
give you
of
the hint.
Detail.
So there's a kind of nice happy ending to it as well, but we commissioned a famous novelist, British novelist, to write about the general election in 2017. And I wanted this novelist to write about sort of state of the nation, the feelings of just being a person who could write well and be sensitive to the environment about how it felt to be around during this election. This piece comes in, I think it's on a week before publication, and it doesn't mention really the election at all. It doesn't mention Jeremy Corbyn at all, even though it was, you know, his in the rise a bit of Jeremy Corbyn and his subsequent not quite making it. And it was just wibbly. It was just awful. I mean, and the editor who I had to deal with just said, I just can't do anything with this. And I'd cleared the first three pages of the paper because it was the election issue.
That is editor's worst nightmare, isn't it?
And it was a complete
typesetter's
worst. Yeah, and it was already. Do you remember reading it? It was irredeemably bad. And I was thinking, what are we going to do? And then, this sounds ridiculous, but I promise you, it's true. We'd had a complaint from Martin Scorsese 3 months before about a film review we'd done of his films, and he'd sent a complaint that we made a couple of mistakes in it, and Adam Mars-Jones had made a remark that films weren't as good at novel as novels at interiority or something like that. And he'd complained, we'd published his letter, and I'd emailed him back saying, well, if you want to make the case why films are an art that's undervalued, we would of course run anything you'd want to write about it. And honestly, the day after we'd had this disastrous arrival, in my inbox popped 1600 words.
Oh my God.
Perfectly written by Martin Scorsese about why film is an undervalued art form that required virtually nothing to it. So we made a whole film issue.
Those moments are so rare.
That is never, ever going to happen
No,
again.
It's not. It's not.
But also, you still had to go back to the well-known novelist and say, so you know we can't print this, right?
Do you get a bit of this? It's a kind of gossipiness, isn't there, to any form of editing?
Oh, yeah, we all
editing.
Know it. I mean, you know, fourth wall of journalism. You have to take it down sometimes. You were making a point on Twitter about the literary world closing ranks.
Yes. About the Booker Prize.
About the Booker Prize. But journalism also closed. I know a very well-known journalist always thought we should have a site called rawcopy.com. Which would be brilliant, wouldn't it? And I don't know if anybody else here has sat watching journalists collect awards and think, yeah, well.
Well, can I tell you something else?
I've seen that copy when it comes in.
Yes.
There's a phrase which I hear all the time from hardworking editors when I like a piece. I always say, I really like that piece. And they go, It's always a pause. Should have seen it when it came in.
Yeah. Although now you just leave the pause and you don't even. Yeah, need
I don't need to say
out.
It. Cause, but that's true. So are there some people who are rewarded for quality of writing, which is effectively an editing job? Do you think?
Well, I think we all know that, don't we? We all know that. But it does. This is sounding very much. Of, you know, this is for myself. This is sounding very much what have the Romans ever done for us? It really is.
Thank God for editors.
I feel kind of, yeah, thank God for us, guys.
Do you think the literary world does close? We could talk about the Booker Prize because we have a piece in the paper this week.
Yeah, I thought it was a brilliant piece.
It's Sam Jordison from the publisher of Duck's New Report. And it's not a moan about not winning. It's a really angry. I mean, he's genuinely angry about,
and upset. I think, yeah, kind of traumatised and out of
and
pocket.
Confused
that, about I this ridiculous that. Decision to. We talked about it last week on the podcast to give to two books, and also effectively, as Afua Hirsch said, who's one of the judges, they gave it to Margaret Atwood for her sort of sustained brilliance over a career. And it's five judges. It obviously was possible to give it to one winner and they didn't. Does it matter? I mean, I think it's ridiculous and embarrassing and shouldn't have been done, but does it matter in the scheme of things, Alex?
Well, I mean, in the, you know, when we say this, what scheme of things is that? You know, yeah. in the global scheme of things, well, kind of no. In terms of when you're talking about kind of level playing fields and closing ranks, I think it does. And actually what I think is that we should use this as I believe they say, a teachable moment. And one of the things I think is that Sam Jordison has written really eloquently about things that people just generally might not know that much about how much it physically costs you to have an author shortlisted.
£5,000 you know, or £6,000.
At least, and then that's all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah,
and then the expenses of their travel
just
to all
massive,
the various
they're
engagements.
They're massively out of pocket. And I really think this is a moment to say to the Booker Prize and to other large prizes, when you open your doors to small independent presses, do not charge them the same fees as you charge HarperCollins, Penguin, Random House. You don't have to. I'll tell you what, if you're short of money, we'll all go without our starter at the great big knees up in the Guildhall. Do you know what I mean?
If you've got 50 grand to give to a winner, you've got 10 grand to support a small
you really
press
have.
To be
and
part
I
of it.
I just don't think that there should be a sliding scale. It levels the playing field. It doesn't make it unfair for them. It levels it. It means you're actually not bankrupting things because you can't just say, well, you know, they know the rules. No. Well, what is a small press to do? Say to a novelist, I want to publish you, but we can't enter you for the Booker Prize. It's just, and that is the thing we could actually do something about.
And also,
it also works in favour of the bigger publishers who can then say, as was the case with Sam Jordison, with Gallibega Press, the big publishers can come along and say, look, you're not going to be able to do this. Why don't you let us come, take this book from you, publish it as our own book, and then we can submit it for those prizes.
Because what his piece makes you realise is it's not just based on, it should just be five people in a room reading a book, reading six books and saying which the one they like the most.
Yes.
And that's really all it boils down to,
isn't
it?
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, the Booker Prize Foundation would say that's absolutely right. I don't blame them. I don't think they are edging people towards making lifetime achievement awards at all. I think they're probably horrified.
You feel this
happened.
Was a lifetime achievement award. I mean, Sam makes the case that it's a lifetime achievement award for both of them, because Afua Hirsch's column talks about they're both, on one hand, Bernardine underrated for a great career, and other one, Margaret Atwood, correctly rated for a great career, and those two were kind of taken together.
Yeah, I think that there's something in that. I mean, I certainly think that it would just have been a better thing all round to give Bernardine Evaristo.
Do you think?
The prize.
Have you read the book?
Yeah, I have.
I've read
it.
It's a great book. Yeah, I thought it was good.
And I think if you feel strongly enough about that book that you want it to win, then let it win alone. Yes, I do. But I actually came away feeling, in a way, just much more sorry for the four other shortlisted books. Who just obviously, when a prize is won, the shortlist falls away to a certain extent. Yeah. But they fell off a cliff.
And does this matter? I mean, it links back to Granted. I mean, this is fun in some ways, but it's kind of important. You know, we're talking this whole podcast about the value of magazines and maybe they're disappearing, and this whole issue of the TLS is about that. Do you think it matters that there are things like book prizes at one level, but more specifically things like grants are existing?
Just ways for books, yeah. No, ways for writing to get recognition that is not just down to one book in between hard or soft covers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
And
of course, I think a literary culture is the most important thing that we have, you know, beyond that sits around individual books, of course, yeah.
And
you have to accept that if you put the word best in a title on something like with Granter's Best of Young British Novelists, you know, once a decade, that helps. It can certainly help. So it can't perform as a function.
But equally, if you remember, Alex, we got you to do, because really there's this feeling that we all had that that list, that Granta 83 list, which had Ishiguro and Amos and Swift and Rushdie and all of that lot, had cast such a long shadow, too long a shadow. We asked loads of people to sort of come up with other novelists that they were excited about, and you wrote that piece about it. And that shows you the impact that Grant has had, that it was necessary to do, because a lot of what is considered good, Salman Rushdie's still on the Booker shortlist however many years
from
after that,
18,
37 years later. That shows the impact of Granta.
And, you know, well, yes, and you know, Extract from Midnight's Children published in it, and great support for his early work and early career. Yeah, I think it is important. It's so interesting to think that that list originally started essentially as a kind of marketing tool.
Alex, what a great pleasure it was reading this. And
talking. Oh, it was fun to do. I actually have to say, halfway through the kind of going through the boxes, I thought, why have I wasted my life being a literary hack extraordinaire? I could have just sat in among boxes looking at fascinating correspondence
being
for
an
50 years.
Would be fantastic,
wouldn't it?
Sitting around boxes. It's the dream. That's the dream. Alex Clark, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
This year, Lydia Davis, best known for flash fiction and masterly translations of Proust and Flaubert, has been unprecedentedly absorbed by her garden. Specifically, she's become acutely aware of the life of what many would call weeds, but which she calls volunteers, who, in Lydia's telling, manifest independence and decisiveness in cultivating a patch of their own choosing, coming in overlapping relays to perform some superficially unobvious role. She quotes Henry David Thoreau's admiration of how each waited a whole year and then blossomed the instant it was ready, and the earth was ready for it. Indeed, Thoreau looks over her shoulder every time she bends to examine a new arrival, whispering his observations about the plant's properties and purpose for Lydia to add to her own. Does this week's beautiful short essay constitute a kind of manifesto against weeding, then? I, for one, certainly hope so. Lydia Davis joins us on the line from New York State now. Hello, Lydia.
Hello.
Hello.
Pleased to be here.
Is your garden in view?
Only if I stand up and look out the window.
I'm just wondering how to picture you. Have you always admired Thoreau, or has he sort of only recently fully clicked with you?
Well, actually, I admired him very early on when I was a youngster, a teenager, or even preteen, perhaps, but teenager anyway. And he actually inspired me to run away from boarding school briefly.
Amazing.
I had read about Walden, and I dreamed of living alone in the woods and just reading and being self-sufficient among the trees, and took off one night with a backpack full of Shakespeare and rolls from dinner. I don't know how I thought I was going to survive, but...
Who cares? That is an absolutely magnificent thing to do, though, isn't it?
It was exciting and scary. They did find me after about 3 miles of walking and bring me back.
So not after 2 years, 2 months and 2 days.
But I had a plan. I had a map. I knew where I was going and everything.
I reread Walden again recently, and I wondered whether it's... I wasn't disappointed with it, but there's large chunks of it that just didn't sing at all to me. I wondered whether the idea of Walden is greater than the actual book itself. I don't know. Do you love the texture of the book, Lydia?
Well, you know, I have to admit it's been years and years since I read it, so I can't answer from a fresh reading, but it must have inspired me, whatever he said. I think people have recently turned against him a bit because they idealized him, or, you know, early on, and then learned that he went home to his mother for dinner
and had his washing done.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I mean, it turns out that Walden Pond is actually very close to the town center. It's really not that far away. I looked on a map. So, you know, it's quite natural.
Well, fair enough.
I don't blame him.
His retreat, though, to Walden Pond, I mean, that was a reaction to his times. It was desire to be away from the kind of the corruption and inequity of the state at the time. Does your gardening, does that represent something similar to you?
Well, I suppose. I mean, he also wanted to live a more concentrated and deliberate life, I think. And I think that's true of me, too. Now, I've pulled in, and it is a bit of a reaction, certainly to global warming, climate change. I'm not flying anymore. I just decided last spring. And I was quite a traveler overseas. Now I have to look at my community right around me and see what's here. And then it starts with my yard and a more intensive concentration on my yard and what I can do here.
Do you think that's a viable future for everyone, where people will have to narrow their horizons? Because, of course, one of the things that you're most famous for is translation, the idea of broadening people's horizons. And do you think we're going to have to collectively say, let's focus in nearer to home, because travelling further afield is no longer the correct moral thing to do?
Well, I think it's both at once. It's more complicated, because at the same time that I've narrowed, you know, physically staying closer to home, my mind is sort of adventuring out into territories I hadn't experienced before. It's very interesting, it turns out, to limit yourself and see what you can do with what's here and the people who are here and the places that are nearby. So I feel the opposite of narrowing. And of course, we have at the moment so much technology that allows us to be in touch with people at a distance and to communicate long distance, to work long distance. So we ought to be able to stay home.
I like the idea that this is a defense of weeds, and not being too rigorous and ordered. I'm no gardener at all. Theo, you're a bit of a gardener, aren't you?
I mean, I'd like to say I am.
Yeah.
But I think I'm letting the weeds do their thing. I'm following Lydia Davis's advice and letting the weeds do what they need to do.
Is this a moral thing? Is this a moral case for weeds, do you think, Lydia?
No, it was just a fascination with what was here, you know, the richness that was here. So instead of mowing it, I wanted to see what would grow. And it's just been like a bounty, you know, hundreds of plants. And I'm not saying, you know, we couldn't quite bring ourselves to let all the lawns go up and grow up and have a wild landscape here. But so it's been a little more cautious, a patch here and weeds around the bases of trees.
I mean, there does have to be a bit of management, because if you let them just completely do their thing, then as far as I can tell anyway, and as I say, my knowledge is limited, something will take over and not give the other things a chance to thrive as well. And that's, you know, weeds among the weeds as well.
Yes, and I'm always told, well, this is meant to be forest, so if you don't do anything, it will revert to forest. Mm-hmm. And for a while, I thought, I'll let it do that. That was actually a year or two ago, the meadow. I said, let's just leave it alone. But then it got overrun by a horrible vine, like sort of wild blackberry or something, that clearly was going to take over the entire meadow. So then I had to start mowing that.
Have you read Weeds in Defense of Nature's Most Unloved Plants by Richard Mabey?
Not yet.
That sounds very much like it should be on your shelf. And it's interesting because it gives a really clear lesson in how loaded the language that we use to talk about weeds is. I mean, weeds itself is a very loaded term, isn't it? It's kind of
absolutely
parasites.
I don't use it.
Yeah, and you call them volunteers, he calls them outlaws and rebels.
Or volunteer wild plants, you know, I like the full. But I did read Wilding by Isabella Tree.
Yeah. Mm.
And that was very, very encouraging in a way that if you do give nature a chance, it'll rebound and all the creatures that live in a certain habitat will come back, or not all of them, but lots of them.
So has this new approach altered your sense of things, of time passing?
It's slowed it down, I suppose, in a nice way. Each day is very intensively spent, you know, outdoors, and not so much right now anymore, but watching and tending, and that does tend to slow things down in a nice way.
I've got a horrible confession to make, Lydia. I've got plastic grass.
Oh God!
At home,
what?
In my garden.
I can't believe you just admitted to that.
I've got three children under 10, And so the thinking was that when it rains, they can run around outside straight afterwards rather than churning into a mud thing. But I'm not very happy about it. Do you think that we are becoming, not just me personally, you can attack me personally if you like, but just generally, we're slightly progressively moving further away from nature, except when people take steps like you do, that it's kind of an extreme. You're either reverting back to wilding or you're completely cosseted away from nature.
Well, I think maybe like many things, the last, say, 80 years, we've moved away from nature, but I think we're going to go back because there's so much interest now in, say, having green rooftops, and we're going to have to plant trees in cities and, you know, more trees because of the climate. And I think so. I think it's going to go back the other way. I think there's a lot of interest in getting closer to nature again. It's had to be very deliberate, unfortunately. You know, let's go out and take a forest bath, you know, which is what people do around here, not meaning literally bathing, but immersing themselves spiritually in the woods.
Do they call it that? They call it a forest bath?
Yes, I think that's right. And it's a little odd, but it just means people are returning.
And meanwhile, everyone listening to this should go out and let weeds grow in their garden.
Well, some weeds in some parts of the garden.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm not going to tear up the grass. Can I wait till my children are a bit older and then tear up the plastic grass, do you think?
But your children ought to find out about all the wonderful things that grow in
a
garden.
Yeah, that's true. We have plants. I feel like I sound like a terrible person. There's a park nearby.
I've just got so many questions about the grass. Does it hurt if they fall on
it? No, it's soft. It's basically, it's just convenient.
Does it sweat?
No. It doesn't sweat. I'm
almost sure it gets hotter in the summer.
It probably does. Yeah, that is true. All right.
It's dangerous.
They measured temperatures in one city, maybe it was in the southwest here. The temperature around trees, the temperature at a sidewalk or on asphalt, and then the temperature in grass. And grass was by far the cooler.
Yeah.
The cooler surface. So you might want to think about that.
All right, Lydia, you've
we'll take this off air, I think.
She's going to shout at me afterwards. Lydia Davis, it's a really charming piece, and it's and maybe we could come back to you after another season, and you can tell us what happens then.
Well, I think I'm actually going to follow up with another piece about how to have a garden that looks nice despite the untidy weeds.
I could really do with that, yeah. So please, please do.
Lydia, you're not only a great translator of Proust, which I read it actually a couple of months ago, you're now going to be the TLS's gardening correspondent.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I'll be happy to do that.
That sounds like a deal to me. Lydia Davis, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's all we have time for today. Our thanks go to Lydia Davis, Catherine Morris and Ros Dineen and Alex Clark. Get subscribing to the TLS. Having listened to all that stuff about the need to support journalism, you'd have to be an utterly heartless person not to. This week we have Alan Rusbridger of The Guardian, formerly, on Snowden and the definitive white swipe at the Booker Prize from the publisher of one of the losing finalists. Next week, it's philosophy, Thea's favourite. We'll consider ourselves to have failed if we don't deal with democratic and constitutional theory in a way that even thickies like me can understand. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.